This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. November 23rd is National Espresso Day. Espresso is a beverage, or at least a component of one, that many Americans have already consumed today by this hour. In the second part of our show, we're talking with the owners of some local favorites, Bennett's Fresh Roast and Grumpy Goat Coffee, about the lesser-known holiday coming up this Thursday. But first, the number of opioid-related deaths in Florida increased 35% in 2016, according to a report released last week by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. That report, based on data collected from medical examiners across the state, finds that overdose deaths caused by the powerful synthetic opioid fentanyl shot up 97% last year, and that the presence of fentanyl in overdose victims increased 80%. The opioid crisis in Florida is having broader impacts beyond drug users themselves. Lee Health neonatologist Dr. William Liu says that the number of drug-dependent babies born to addicted mothers has increased 1,200% in Lee County since 2005. And this past summer, the Florida Department of Health in Lee County reported that more than 1,200 children had been removed from their homes, as well as more than 600 newborns in the five-county area that the agency oversees just in the past year, and that's largely been due to issues related to substance abuse. As the opioid crisis in Florida and around the nation intensifies, politicians have taken notice. Governor Rick Scott has declared Florida's opioid crisis a public health emergency, and last month, President Trump ordered the Department of Health and Human Services to declare the epidemic a public health emergency as well. State lawmakers here in the Sunshine State are looking to tackle the problem through a variety of proposed bills when they convene the 2018 legislative session in January. These bills include efforts to expand the use of Florida's prescription drug monitoring database, to limit the supply of certain opioid drugs that doctors would be able to prescribe to patients, as well as a proposal to launch a pilot program in Southwest Florida aimed at helping newborns suffering with neonatal abstinence syndrome. Today, we're taking a closer look at some of these bills as we gain perspective from some of those working on the front lines of the opioid crisis here in Southwest Florida. Joining me now in studio is Lee Health Emergency Department Physician Dr. Aaron Wall. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Wall.
Thank you very much for having me, John. I appreciate being here.
Also with us in studio is the Director of Residential Programs at Salus Care, Stephen Hill. Salus Care provides comprehensive behavioral health care services here in Southwest Florida, which, of course, largely includes addressing issues related to addiction and substance abuse. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Russell Vega. He's the Chief Medical Examiner for Florida's 12th Judicial Circuit, which encompasses Manatee, DeSoto, and Sarasota counties. In recent years, this region, specifically the Bradenton area, has become known as the opioid overdose capital of Florida. Dr. Vega, always great to hear from you. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, John.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Call in and connect with our experts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. Or on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And Dr. Vega, let's begin with you. Can you tell us a bit more about this report released last Wednesday by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement? This is primarily based on data provided by medical examiners like yourself, correct?
That's right. And the report is really, it's a flagship type of report in the nation because Florida leads the nation in our desire and our ability to collect data and present it in an organized way in a report like the one you're talking about. Really, no other state to this point has been producing this kind of information, especially for as long as Florida has. So we really have a better grip on this than many states do. The report, from my perspective, is very helpful, but you know, it takes a while to get all this results, all the results back, and all the data tabulated. So, as good as the report is, we're still somewhat behind the curve in terms of using this data.
So, would you say that an impetus for providing this level of detailed data, perhaps comes maybe not even so much from the opioid crisis we're facing right now, but from several years ago, whenever we saw a lot of the problem coming from unscrupulous pain management clinics, the pill mills?
Yeah, and in fact, the state started collecting this data even years before then, really when cocaine was the primary impetus of the state in terms of drug tracking. And since that time, the state has collected a broader array of data on different drugs, and certainly starting in 2007, 2008, when the prescription drug deaths really started to pick up, the state expanded the sort of different drugs they were looking at, and it was at that time that we really picked up on all the deaths that started occurring from especially oxycodone here in the state of Florida.
When it comes to this latest data we saw released last week, were you in any way surprised by the pretty high increases year over year between 2015 and 2016, or is this part of a larger pattern you've seen building for a number of years?
Well, we have seen this pattern building, and I have to say that I personally wasn't surprised at the data that came out statewide, because we'd been experiencing this locally, throughout 2016 and carrying through to 2017 as well. I think if you look at the trend we saw starting maybe in 2014, probably all of us were surprised with the strength and rapidity of the spike we saw in illicit intravenous drug deaths, first starting with heroin, and then transferring to more fentanyl deaths, and now the onslaught of deaths we've had from the fentanyl analogs. And an analog is a drug which is similar to, or a chemical which is similar to another drug, but is different in some small way. And it's the fentanyl analogs that we've really seen causing the large number of deaths for, say, the second half of 2016 and in 2017.
Let's just take a step back and explain exactly what we're talking about when we're referring to drugs like fentanyl and fentanyl analogs. What are they, and how do they relate to, you know, other illicit drugs like heroin?
Well, all of these drugs are what we would call opioid narcotics. They are drugs that, in the beginning, were all derived from the opium plant, and that's where morphine and heroin came from. But as medical and pharmaceutical technology improved, we developed variations on those medications which served additional purposes. That's where drugs like oxycodone came from. And another drug in that category is fentanyl, but fentanyl is entirely a synthesized drug. It was created in the laboratory to assist with long-term pain management, and in that effect, it was very effective. But over the last couple of years, we've seen that fentanyl has been produced illegally in laboratories, or at least produced in laboratories outside of our country and then brought in, not on a prescription basis, but just brought in illegally, and has been used as a drug of abuse from that, just from that perspective, from being distributed on the street, essentially. And then once that fentanyl was in place and was causing a good number of deaths, we started to see a transition to drugs which were harder to identify and more potent. And those are drugs which were like fentanyl, but chemists had changed the structure of the fentanyl molecule just a little bit to make it either more potent or harder to identify or beneficial in some other way from the perspective of the people who were distributing the drugs. So we started with fairly, if you will, simple drugs like heroin and morphine, and now we've got numerous drugs that are causing, from my perspective, causing death, and certainly causing morbidity that I'm sure your other guests will talk about. And that's that technological progress, which was good at first, has ended up being a real problem for us now.
And just Dr. Wall, physiologically, if someone overdoses and dies because they've taken one of these powerful opioids, what is actually going on? They stop breathing, their heart stops. What actually causes death?
Yeah, essentially opioids in general are not toxic to the system, except for the fact that they diminish a patient's respiratory drive. And so basically at the base of the brain, they suppress that respiratory drive to the point where the patient eventually begins to stop breathing. Initially, it can start with a very slow progress where they just get more shallow breaths, and then eventually they cease breathing. When that happens, obviously, there's no further oxygen getting into the blood supply, and you undergo brain death simply because of lack of oxygen to the brain. Now, with these prescription opioids in general, and even heroin to a certain degree, that episode could take a few minutes, even 5 to 8 minutes. But with the potency of fentanyl and its being put into the heroin system and also into new counterfeit pills, so they look like prescription pills, but they contain large amounts of fentanyl, mm-hmm. that episode of apnea, or where you stop breathing, occurs very rapidly over, 10 to 30 seconds. And so there's less time to find that patient. There's less time to revive the patient. There's less time to get them Narcan. And so that's where the devastating consequences are coming from. And I think it's important to point out that heroin costs about, they say, wholesale to develop from a poppy and get, the material and then turn it into heroin on the street. It's about $65,000 a kilo. Illicitly manufactured fentanyl in these laboratories in China and now even in Mexico is about $3,500 a kilogram. So obviously it benefits the dealer to cut the heroin with that. And unfortunately, under anecdotal reports, it looks like, although people realize how dangerous the fentanyl is, it appears that those that are addicted to opioids are actually seeking out heroin with fentanyl in it because of those, the powerful quality that it is. It's approximately 50 times as strong as morphine.
Okay. Well, I want to get back to, talking about your experience in the emergency room and maybe how that's changed, thanks to the opioid crisis in recent years. But Dr. Vega, similar question. What is your office dealing with in terms of, increased demand for autopsies, and how are your staff able to keep up, or do you need more resources?
Well, we definitely needed more resources. The increase in overdose deaths impacted our overall workload by about 20% over the last 2 years, and 20% for us is a number that's hard to absorb without additional staff. So we did have to hire an additional medical examiner, another doctor, and investigators to handle this increased caseload.
And I know you were also appointed to the Florida Violent Crime and Drug Control Council by Governor Scott a few years ago. Can you tell me about the council and if much in the way of possible solutions or progress is coming out of that work group?
Well, I wish I could report a lot of progress there, but unfortunately the council doesn't have a lot of funding right now. So at the moment, they deal with two different aspects. One has to do with distribution of dollars for programs that they're not directly impacted by overdoses, and that's a part of the council that I'm not really involved with. And the other part doesn't really have any funding right now, so we haven't been able to do much.
Gotcha.
Unfortunately.
And Dr. Wall, as an emergency room physician with Lee Health, and I guess I should just say, in the interest of full disclosure, I did used to work under you at the Health Park emergency room years ago. And I recently, a couple months ago, ran into some of your physician colleagues in the ER. And, we were talking about, maybe a decade ago, how sometimes you would have this downtime, particularly in overnight shifts, and they were just saying that's not part of the reality anymore. And that's not entirely fueled by the opioid crisis, but, anecdotally, is that a big piece of it in part?
I'd say, my experience personally, anecdotally, with the opioid crisis, I'd say it's an approximation. If you considered a 24-hour shift, I'd say it's not overblowing it to say that maybe 4 to 5 overdoses per 24-hour shift can occur. And that can occur, it seems like, when perhaps a new batch of fentanyl or heroin reaches the streets. And so, Friday, Saturday, that type of thing, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. What we're experiencing and what has been different from the last 10 years is that probably around 2013 or so, as fentanyl found its way into the heroin supply and legislation sort of diminished access to pill mills, the overdoses are almost exclusively heroin and fentanyl.
Wow.
From what we experience in the emergency department. And it's very, very difficult because that gets into sort of the broader issues of, many of these patients are completely uninsured. Many of these patients, really, we don't have many options to send them to as far as therapy. They're currently addicted They've come in with an overdose. We've revived them. And that's the easy part. The more difficult part is actually finding that person meaningful addiction treatment as an outpatient. Right. And that's, you know, where I've been sort of the most vocal with lawmakers is sort of pleading to make that more available. And unfortunately, that's a very complex subject and it's difficult because it involves money. But certainly what we can do in the emergency department is educate the patient on harm reduction. And harm reduction means we know that person's going to continue to use, so we teach them how to keep themselves safe while using. We dispense Narcan, which is the antidote for overdose. And then lastly, we urge them to try and find treatment. And personally, my personal opinion is, and really in the medical community, the gold standard of treatment is medication-assisted treatment. And that involves three different medications. That's methadone, buprenorphine, or naltrexone. And so providers of those treatment modalities in our community are woefully lacking, and funding for that is extraordinarily lacking. And even if you are insured, there's long-term waiting lists. And it's at that point where the person sort of decides that they want to stop, and then if they unfortunately relapse, a lot of times that's when they get a fatal overdose. Mm. And so that's where we're most desperate is what do we do and who do we send the patient out to in the community to aid with that patient's addiction? Because that's really what we're dealing with. I mean, it's not necessarily only an opioid crisis. It's really an addiction crisis.
Absolutely. Let's take a call now from Marcus in South Fort Myers. Marcus, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you, John. I have frustration because I've been hearing about this problem for years. And your program is a perfect example of how we're addressing the front line, law enforcement, the hospitals, everybody having to deal with it. But if we all saw 60 Minutes about a month ago, we realized this is practically a government-sanctioned epidemic. These are not drugs being smuggled in from Mexico. These are manufacturers legally making the drugs and profiting like crazy all over America. American manufacturers making this stuff. And as we saw in 60 Minutes, they're lobbying to take away the DEA's power pretty much makes them fully authorized pushers and dealers and distributors of this drug epidemic that is killing so many people. Now, I suggest that we start tying their profits right to reimbursement to law enforcement and hospitals and the medical profession for all the enormous amounts of money that we're all eating, whether it's public through taxes or the medical companies, the hospitals. I mean, this is costing America trillions of dollars. We see how on 60 Minutes, we saw how Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee and we saw how Tom Marino of Pennsylvania have completely sold their souls to the drug companies to basically put money in their campaign pockets. And I don't see you guys addressing this. You're doing a great job addressing the problem on the front line, but you're not talking about the supply. You're not talking about the source of the problem. You're talking about the result. You're talking about the symptoms, but not really the cause. And I really think that there should be more public outrage about that. Everybody should watch that 60 Minutes from about a month ago because it should make everybody mad, whether they know somebody who was the victim of this or not. Thank you.
Thanks, Marcus. I think he makes an interesting point there. I've also been looking, though, at a recent report from the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission finding that China is, in fact, a major source for illicit fentanyl in South Florida and elsewhere in the U.S. So, I think certainly there is a lot of blame to go around. I don't want to dismiss Marcus's point there at all. I guess, Stephen Hill, when it comes to addressing causes and symptoms, I imagine you would be thinking at it from more of a perspective of what is someone, as part of the pathology of addiction itself and helping people recover and figure out perhaps, what led them towards addiction in the first place.
Yes. And as has been said many times, this is a very layered problem. We have seen a shift from where we had the primary prescription medications, and then we saw the more illicit drugs come in, and then the series of the synthetics, which continue to change all the time. Unfortunately, China at the end of 2015 had actually did some legislation which they banned production of several chemicals. And as was said earlier, fentanyl was included. And then we start seeing all of these fentanyl analogs, furanyl, acetyl, different types of fentanyl coming out. The addiction is treated the same for the person. The hardest part of what I do is engaging. You know, they can go into the hospital. They get lots of great referrals. We can set people up for admissions, you know, every day of the week. And without fail, we have those individuals who end up not coming in.
Right.
And then we'll see the name again later. We work really hard to provide that the treatment that they need and to engage them. And we're looking into medication-assisted treatment, as was said earlier, that it's needed, it's necessary, it's something that our agency is wanting to get involved in. As has been said many times, there's a lot of issues with funding.
Right.
And being able to support that. So we're invested in moving forward and providing the best quality treatment and engaging people and getting everyone to engage in that treatment. We know addiction is a lifelong chronic disease, but we also know you can successfully manage that disease, and that's our goal with everyone we see.
Let's talk about that funding issue for a minute, particularly when it comes to, you know, the behavioral health aspects of the crisis. I know Governor Scott's budget proposal included $50 million for, you know, the opioid crisis, and some of that money would be going towards recovery and mental health help there. But at the same time, I know this year we lost a $20.4 million federal block grant for substance abuse and mental health, and that's left state lawmakers kind of scrambling, you know, looking for where some of this money is going to come from. And we also know from, you know, the state's own chief economist, Amy Baker, that as lawmakers go into this next session in January, we're not looking at budget surpluses here. They're already projecting pretty large deficits. You know, we've already spent money from 2018 on IRMA recovery, and we're now firmly in the red going into this next session. I mean, what does that mean for you and for organizations like SalusCare?
It means for us we're constantly trying to do more with less. Mm-hmm. We have an increasing number of people. We have in a lot of circumstances, a more challenging population coming in, and the revenues aren't there to support all of the needs. So we really focus on doing as much as we can with what we have and bringing people in, and not and for those who don't have funding or for those who are uninsured, you know, being able to bring them in at a very affordable or no cost. But there are limitations to that. Also, you know, we can't provide services to everyone for free, of course,
right,
and be able to sustain. So it's a constant balancing act, and it's constantly trying to continue or provide more services with a lot of times less people.
Got you. And what kind of a percentage would you say of folks who do get help through SalusCare or are there for issues related to substance abuse versus other behavioral health issues?
I was running that number. We have a lot of patients who come in under the terminology co-occurring, which means they have substance use in conjunction with mental health. And then we have exclusive mental health and exclusive substance abuse. So a lot of times there's an overlap. We see a lot of our patients, especially in the population that I'm working with on the residential substance side, typically around 60 to 70% of those individuals are co-occurring. We've got a mental health disorder going on with their substance use. I was looking at numbers this morning just since the start of the year, just looking at how many people this year, percentage-wise, have we served due to opiates, and the number came in at about 71%. In our detox and residential settings. So that leaves, you know, roughly 30% for all the other drugs. So we can definitely see the shift has been made, and opiates are the primary problem.
Gotcha. And I know, Stephen, you and Dr. Wall both participated back in August in a roundtable discussion with other stakeholders, other members of Southwest Florida State Legislative Delegation, and other local elected officials like Mayor Randy Henderson here in Fort Myers. Can you tell us a little bit about that roundtable discussion and kind of what was discussed there? And I guess maybe the importance of bringing together stakeholders from all these different facets that are being impacted by this epidemic.
And that was one of the huge goals in doing this, was to bring everyone together and see how everyone can support one another to meet the need as best we can for what's going on currently. There was, you know, fire departments, police stations, local government, statewide government, saying, okay, we recognize we have this huge problem going on. Now, how can we collectively fix it? And that was the challenge moving forward to all of us, was let's figure out a system that collects everyone as a whole and working together so that it's not compartmentalized, so that everyone is on the same page and we're all going in the same direction and working together instead of, you know, everyone kind of doing their individual things, which is really good for us moving forward because, you know, a lot of times the first time a patient will be seen is coming into the emergency room. You know, they've overdosed, they're being brought in. The hospital basically, as you said, you know, a lot of times are bringing them back, but that's only step one. We still have an individual who needs treatment. We still have an individual who may need a medical detox. We have lots of pieces to the puzzle, and the goal for all of us is to work together to meet that need.
Gotcha. And Dr. Wall, I know when you spoke at that roundtable discussions, one of the things that you spoke about was this no pain philosophy that seems so deeply set in how we approach medicine, and how maybe that's partially responsible or needs to change.
Yeah, among other things that I spoke about, I did discuss they offered what would you do if you were king for a day kind of scenario. Mm-hmm. And I said sort of an outline would be to prevent addiction, to control supply, and definitely talk about prescribing, and then protect those who are addicted through reducing harm and preventing fatal overdoses. And then I went into medication-assisted treatment. But the first sort of chapter of that discussion was that I was asking, honestly, for community-wide education to, everybody will immediately jump on doctors and sort of vilify doctors in this crisis. And we certainly have a role and a responsibility. But I was trying to express sort of what the other gentleman who called about said, and mm-hmm. that was the influence of big pharmaceutical industries on our expectation of Americans to control our pain. And, we're 5% of the world's population, but we consume more than 60% of the world's opioid supply. We also make up 30% of the world's drug overdoses. And, you know, why is that? Are these other countries not experiencing pain? And really, that's because of the marketing genius, or I would say it was a juggernaut. We were sold in the early 90s this epidemic of untreated pain. And that was created by what was called the Pain Care Forum. And the Pain Care Forum was a Washington consortium made up of what looked like academic pain societies named the American Pain Foundation, American Pain Society, American Academy of Pain Medicine. And what they did was they were essentially marketing arms of Big Pharma. And the most culpable one was Purdue Pharma, and that was the maker of OxyContin. And interestingly, in about 95, 96, OxyContin teamed up with the Joint Commission, which was a nonprofit hospital accreditor, and they created this concept of pain as the fifth vital sign. Not only that, they made patient satisfaction scores concerning pain control, and these were tied to physician reimbursement and ranking.
Oh, wow.
And because of that, because of this creation of this fifth vital sign for pain, and that physicians were essentially unethical if we did not treat pain to zero level, to a level of 0 out of 10, as a result, opioids quadrupled and our prescriptions for opioids quadrupled from 1999 through 2014, and as did fatalities just the same. And, this isn't just supposition, or this isn't just innuendo. Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty and agreed to pay more than $600 million in fines in 2007 for misleading the public about the risks of OxyContin. And yet that drug has continued to rack up more than $32 billion in sales over the last 20 years. Prior to the 90s, opioids were previously reserved for the most severe causes of pain, such as post-surgical pain, traumatic pain, severe trauma, injury, terminal illness, and in diseases like cancer. But as a result of this fraudulent marketing and these cadres of pain societies that were marketing arms of the pharmaceutical companies, doctors began prescribing and patients began asking for these medications in more common ailments like back pain, arthritis, and headaches. And so I think, that was important to express. And you can use the example of Japan. Japan is same socioeconomic kind of status as the United States. And if you look at their prescribing, I have to count it on my hand. But if you take what Japan prescribes and you double it and you double it again and you double it again, and you double it a fourth time and you double it a fifth time, they're still number two to the level of opioids that we prescribe in the United States. And again, that's all, you know, that's a multitude of, it's a very complex issue, but it's cultural feelings of Americans and why we should have no pain whatsoever and our expectations about pain. In Japan, big pharma can't advertise directly to patients. Insurance companies don't authorize for opioids as easily. They're usually reserved for specialists. And if you compare that to the United States, where the primary care doctors write for, you know, most of the nationwide prescriptions. And honestly, I'll stop very quickly, but it's really a part of like the Toyotization of medicine, assembly line medicine. We're into cost containment and a quick fix in the United States. So it really, it's difficult to blame doctors often. Doctors were rushed. They get only a few minutes with each case. And insurance companies don't reimburse for, you know, the time talking to the patient. So when you have complex, multifaceted aspects of pain, the patient is essentially, you know, sometimes that involves anxiety and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. And those are very hard conversations that are time-consuming to have. So over the last 20 years, we sort of reached for the prescription pad. And that's what patients have gained, have grown to sort of expect and desire. And so, you know, it's really, it's multifaceted. We have to change our expectations of pain increase modalities of pain treatment that do not involve opioids. And that's expensive. And we have to ask insurance companies to actually have parity and pay for those kinds of treatments. And those are the tougher solutions really to this problem.
What do you think about, you know, some of the bills that have been proposed for the state legislative session here in 2018, you know, as they relate to things like limiting, you know, the day supply of certain opioid drugs, like 2 or 3 day supply, or in some cases a 7 day supply. Do you think this is a good idea?
It's a very, very difficult question to answer directly with a yes or no question. Do I think that's a good idea? I think that it's certainly part of diminishing the amount of legally prescribed opioids is part of a more comprehensive plan, any plan that you look up, to decrease that upstream opioid addiction and possible societal harms. However, you know, when you intensely focus on prescribing as the nucleus for your policy interventions, that reflects a hope that today's opioid addiction crisis was going to be reversed by restricting the prescription opioid supply. And that's honestly quite misguided now that other opioids such as heroin and illicitly manufactured fentanyl and then the counterfeit prescription pills have come to dominate the crisis. So, you know, even as deaths from illicit fentanyl and heroin skyrocketed, you know, you mentioned 100-something% increase, but the CDC says fentanyl deaths are up 540% over 3 years, starting since 2013. And so, you know, society and legislators will fixate on the easier but questionable pill targets. Immediate fatalities will certainly continue, and they'll probably continue to rise because you're really dealing with that issue when you address just the pills that are prescribed. That's the supply side. But what we have is we have a large pool of persons who are already addicted to opioids, and we really need to address them to stop the bleeding. I mean, we're hemorrhaging with fatalities, and you know that's really where we need to focus our best efforts. And to give credit to legislators, you know, there's no simple policy fix. I mean, it really takes sort of a multifaceted approach, and sure, there's numerous bills kind of being proposed. You know, they are trying peer specialist legislation. There's a bill from Garcia, Senate Bill 450. They are expanding needle exchange programs. That's House Bill 579 and Senate Bill 800. And so, you know, they're definitely trying, and they are listening and engaging with physicians as we talk about sort of the idiosyncrasies of restricting opioids and, you know, what is the best tact and what evidence do we have? You know, we're trying to express evidence-based policymaking, and really the evidence out there for correlating prescription pills to future addiction is really observational evidence. It's not prospective evidence. And so you have to be careful of making faulty correlation and actually saying if you use faulty causation, then you can come up with, you know, faulty solutions.
Right.
And that's what we're most concerned about.
Well, you know, Dr. Vega, while we've got you on the line, you know, and we're looking at, you know, fentanyl maybe specifically here, is there a way when you do autopsies to tell whether fentanyl was contributed to someone's death or was perhaps the cause of the overdose, whether it was obtained through a legitimate prescription or if it was illicit fentanyl?
You can't by looking at the body or by doing specific toxicology testing. It really requires thorough background investigation. If you have, for instance, a prescription for fentanyl patches, which is found at the scene, and you have fentanyl patches on the body at the time you're doing your examination, then you can probably presume that if you identify fentanyl in the toxicology testing in the blood, that the source was from those prescriptions and from those patches. But, you know, most of the cases that we find, we don't have that. Back when I was initially training, almost all of our fentanyl-related deaths had prescriptions and the patch is the most common prescribed form. They were readily evident. And now, I'd say in the fentanyl deaths we've had over the last 2 years, maybe you could count on one hand the number we've had that have had a prescription for fentanyl. So the vast majority of it is the kind which is being illegally imported or synthesized legally or illegally, imported and then sold on the street as an illicit drug. But, you know, for us, the problem is much more with the fentanyl analogs, which are causing many, many more deaths in our jurisdiction than plain fentanyl.
And you know, Dr. Wall, you know, going back to what you were saying there about this problem being so multifaceted, it's interesting because I'm looking at a lot of the bills being proposed for 2018, and they seem to relate specifically to your arena, to physicians and actually prescribing medications. And I'm not saying that these bills are bad, but perhaps we need more as well to address the illicit opioids that are coming in.
Absolutely, and what that gets into is how do you take care of the addicts that are current, those patients that are currently addicted?
Yeah.
And the answer is through harm reduction strategies, which is dispensing of naloxone, engaging in needle exchange programs to prevent a spread of HIV, hepatitis C, and valvular diseases called endocarditis, which cause very, very costly hospitalizations, and then medication-assisted therapy. And increase access to medication-assisted therapy. And, you know, that's really the answer that will – it's not a magic bullet in any way, shape, or form. I mean, you know, with buprenorphine, which they feel like is the most successful medication-assisted therapy, you're talking about a fatality reduction in some studies of about 50% on those patients that actually choose that. But, of course, what percentage of patients come into an emergency department, overdose, we revive them, and then they actually go and engage in that treatment? It's a small percentage of people. Mm-hmm. But it's their only hope is what my argument is. And it's not my opinion. I mean, it's, you know, the medical experts in addiction specialty is we must expand access to medication-assisted treatment to diminish the fatalities.
And Stephen, with Salus Care, are these types of medication-assisted therapies, like Dr. Wall's talking about, you know, with methadone or buprenorphine, are those available at all through Salus Care services? How would someone get those?
They currently are not. We've had lots of discussions within the agency in expanding this and getting doctors who are certified and be able to provide those services. You know, as it's been said, it's very scientifically proven. There's a lot of data to back it up. Addiction treatment for years and years and years was a abstinence-based treatment. You know, you don't do anything, mm-hmm. but we know now that's, especially with opiate treatment, that's not the best thing. There is medication-assisted therapy, and that is far more successful, and it does reduce the overdose death rate, And we also know, you know, as it was said earlier, but we have individuals who may get treatment and they're clean for a brief period of time, that relapse is the highest rate of a fatal overdose, because if I'm clean for a while and I feel like I'm going to go out and relapse, I can do what I used to do.
Right.
But now my body can't handle that anymore. So medication is something we're definitely interested in. We've had multiple conversations about it, and we do want to involve it and incorporate it in what our agency is doing, and we're right now currently trying to navigate that system with doctors and things of that nature to get it in place.
I would add there's sort of a tipping point. You know, he mentioned the Claston abstinence models of addiction, such as 12 steps of AA and NA. And interestingly, they have actually been at odds with the administration of medication-assisted therapy. In other words, they even have a moralistic stigmatization of replacing one addiction for another. So those two camps, you know, medication-assisted camp and then the abstinence camps, have been actually feuding a little bit with each other and creating some issues there. But I'd say at this point, there is a tipping point. Some of the clinics that previously only practice abstinence therapy have now begun to allow those patients in that are on maintenance therapy with buprenorphine, and then they use the 12-step program as cognitive behavioral therapy to augment the treatment with the medication-assisted therapy to much greater success.
Very interesting. Well, unfortunately, we ran out of time several minutes ago, and I didn't end the show. But thank you so much for being here, and I'm sorry that we have to end it here. We've been speaking with Dr. Aaron Wall, an emergency physician with Lee Health. Stephen Hill is with us as well, and he is with Salus Care, providing behavioral health services here in Southwest Florida. We've also been talking with Dr. Russell Vega. He is the chief medical examiner for Florida's 12th Judicial Circuit. Thank you much, all of you, so much, all of you, for being here.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
And we're taking a short break, but when we return, Thanksgiving isn't the only holiday this Thursday. It's also National Espresso Day. It's a beverage, or at least a component of one, that many Americans have already consumed by this time of day. We'll talk with the owners of some local favorites, Bennett's Fresh Roast and Grumpy Goat Coffee, about the holiday after the break. Stay with us.